There's a little bit of a...
There we go.
You were saying, Andre?
There's a little bit of an echo. I don't know, Nathan, if you can hear it on your mic there.
A little bit, but it'll be fine.
I think we'll make do. Okay.
Yeah, so thanks for taking the time to talk to us. I guess, do you want to spend a minute and introduce yourself and your background?
Yeah, first of all, I'm sorry I'm late.
No worries.
I'm an interventional cardiologist. And I started my training back in 1990. So right on my first day of training, I entered into the cath lab. I started doing caths and stents. So I have about almost 30 years of experience being in the cardiac cath lab. So in this time frame, I have probably done over 500 to 600 coronary angiograms every year. So I guess that comes to be about 18,000 or so.
Wow.
In the last 30 years. And then probably have done maybe somewhere in the range of 10,000 coronary interventions, stents or valve expands or similar such procedures. So you could say that I have spent a large amount of my career in the cardiac cath lab. I'm also a cardiologist. I see patients in the office. Over the last 5 years, I have modulated my practice to become a low-carb cardiologist, talking about nutrition, fasting, exercise. And I have been trying to educate people about lipoprotein profile and about the risks and benefits of statins or cholesterol-reducing medicines. So in a nutshell, that's who I am, and I'm hoping I'll bring value to this conversation.
Yeah, that's awesome. You certainly have a ton of clinical experience in the cath lab, which I think is what we were kind of interested to hear about. We had come across through Stephen Hussey, I don't know if you've heard of him, some pathology information from Giorgio Baroldi, who had some statements that made it seem like the cause of a myocardial infarction isn't necessarily the blockage of a coronary vessel. So I guess since you've spent a lot of time unblocking coronary vessels,
looks like we lost him.
We lost him.
I lost you for a few minutes.
No problem. So since you've spent a lot of time unblocking coronary vessels, what is your experience like? Is it your clinical experience that unblocking a coronary vessel resolves symptoms or resolves a MI?
So I forgot to add that I have probably been on call for acute MIs. That means patients coming in with an ongoing heart attack for the last 30 years. And I have had as many as 10 calls a month for upwards of 20 years. So it's not infrequent that I get called in the middle of the night to come take care of a patient having a heart attack. And I can say that when they are coming in with a heart attack, taking them to the cardiac cath lab and opening up their blood vessel is perhaps the best way to resolve their symptoms, the chest pain that they're experiencing. I have given people upwards of 30 milligrams of morphine, which is a very powerful opioid, an analgesic, to help relieve their pain. And their pain does not get relieved, but the minute you open up the blood vessel that was occluded at the time of the heart attack, you see that there is an immediate resolution of chest pain. There is a significant improvement in their EKG. When you occlude a blood vessel, you have what is called ST segment elevation. There is an electrical portion of the EKG, which is the electrical recording of the heart, where there are changes, and those changes resolve upon opening the blood vessel of the heart. So that's an acute situation. Now your question also encompassed whether, like, let's say somebody comes in with a significant blockage and I open up their blood vessel with a stent, but this is not the setting of a heart attack. Does that benefit? And the answer to that is that not always, but frequently. And when I say frequently, it definitely improves their symptoms. So in other words, there are studies that show that their exercise time on treadmill goes up. There are studies that show that their symptoms of angina, which is chest pain related to reduced blood flow to the heart muscle, that improves. There have not been any substantial data about opening up blood vessels that are not causing heart attacks and improving long-term outcome, like reducing the risks of death or reducing the chances of these people having myocardial infarctions. Yeah. So that data...
There's some interesting statistics, particularly on once you open a blood vessel back up, the mortality characteristics, how they change. So if you do like a sham-controlled trial for... So I think when you were talking about that first case where they're having an active heart attack, is that considered like unstable angina versus like a stable angina? Because when you look at the statistics, the five-year mortality rates for someone with stable angina is actually surprisingly high, like or rather low. Like they tend to survive quite a long time. So if the hypothesis is that an occluded blood vessel tends to cause a heart attack and that an occluded blood vessel tends to cause angina, why is it that these people who have stable angina tend to, like, I think Nathan dug up some data that said the survival rate of some, like a 67-year-old male with stable angina is something like 93% over the next 5 years, which we thought was a little bit interesting just from trying to compare, you know, these different hypotheses, because that point about lacking data under differing situations is, I think, kind of interesting to us, because the more we read into this, the more it seems like there may be more going on here when you talk about the electrical system of the heart and the autonomic nervous system and toxicity and all these other possibly dietary mediated factors that could be influencing the heart health and heart attack, if that makes sense.
So so that I can tailor it a little bit better to you, Andre, and to Nathan, can you guys give me a little bit of your background as to, and also the background of who would be, or give me an idea as to who would be listening to these talks?
Yeah, I mean, so we've been spending a lot of time looking into, so my principal concern is that we in the low carb community, it basically started with the observation of like lean mass hyper responders and the elevation of LDL. And mm-hmm. there's a whole bunch of discussion around that. And the conclusion has been a number of times that people tend to say, well, it's possible that the story has more, that there's more to the story than just LDL, and maybe like a lipoprotein-based picture of heart disease is potentially a little myopic, particularly when you look at the pathology observations of someone like Konstantin Velikin, and they observe that, hey, it turns out that if you, you know, crack open a 20-year-old that died in a, you know, was run over by bus, they have atherosclerotic lesions, like early fibrous lesions that have no lipid or cholesterol accumulation whatsoever. So it's clear that, you know, potentially a response to retention model might not be as applicable in that stage, because if the cholesterol isn't there, how did the cholesterol cause the problem? So we're looking a lot at the, I mean, I spent a lot of time focusing on the pathology work from a lot of the doctors who have done, you know, autopsies on to try and reconstruct that time series analysis and looking at other explanations, because one of the big problems that I hear is that we have this idea that maybe LDL isn't as important as we believe it to be, but then we don't have a great story of like, well, what is actually causing heart disease? I guess we can probably point you to, we did a podcast that's about to come out talking a lot about some of the problems that I have with the existing model of atherogenesis and the ways in which we need to improve, because there are just a lot of explanations that, you know, even if you believe the response to retention model, there are 60-year-olds who have absolutely no risk factors who ate a vegetarian diet but dropped dead at the age of 60 from a fatal heart attack with no warning, you know? And those are the things that we lack a good explanation for. And so we're focusing a lot on, you know, trying to connect the dots and look into the the cause per se, you know, and try and understand what's actually driving this disease, because there's clearly a lot of nuance to what's going on here. You know, if you look at Velikin, they talk about there are at least six different discrete types of atherosclerotic lesion, and they follow certain types of progression, and some of them appear to be kind of independent, like, you know, you have a fatty streak, but there's an open question as to whether that's actually a precursor to a mature lesion or whether that's actually just a totally independent pathology. And so we've just been focusing a lot on that and looking at, I mean, I kind of started out with what happens if I look through all the heart disease research and pay no attention to the word lipoprotein. You know, if I completely ignore lipoproteins, what does the story look like? And so that's kind of my background. So we're looking to get an understanding of your perspective on this, because the more we dig into this, the more it's clear that there are aspects of this pathology and the etiology of this disease that we just don't yet have explanations for. And so trying to understand, as an engineer, one of the things that we do is we try to look at the problem from a black box. So we take a step back and say, okay, if I poke it this way, what does it do? And so, you know, by extension, one of these hypotheses is that if we believe that a heart attack is caused by an occluded blood vessel, then how do you explain various observations? Like, there are some autopsies that they've done when they crack people open that were run over by a bus, and they had totally occluded coronary vessels, but absolutely no damage to their heart muscle whatsoever, evidence of previous myocardial infarction. We can send you some of these Baroldi quotes, but they're kind of interesting observations because it's all suggesting that there's more to do, that there's more going on here than might meet the eye from some of these hypotheses that are talked a lot about by, like, the American Heart Association or the other standards bodies, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it kind of gives me a good idea of what where you come from. And so you are an engineer looking at it from a problem-solving root cause analysis standpoint and a citizen scientist. And so I understand that, and I appreciate people like you because you think about things from a totally different perspective because you are not bound by some of the learning that you do through med school, and you are not set in a specific hypothesis. So I like that. So what about you, Nathan? Is your background similar or?
Yeah, similar story. I'm a software engineer. And I went on a keto diet. I saw my LDL go up to a lot. My LDLP is over 3,500. My LDLC is like 500. I followed Dave Feldman's work. Eventually, I met Nick at Low Carb Seattle, and we got chatting, and he had some interesting pieces of the puzzle. And we've been chatting and sharing papers and trying to figure out what the heck's going on since.
And one of the major things is we want to get to the point where we have a hypothesis that can explain more of the observations, because there are certain aspects of this pathology. When you say, why is there atherosclerosis on, you know, right inside the coronary branches, but not on the other side of the artery or you know, several centimeters downstream, you know, what is it about the cause of the disease that can explain the tight localization and the areas of disease next to areas totally lacking in disease? And those are, so we've been going through and trying to understand what are the, you know, when you look at hemodynamics or all these other fields, or, you know, potential endotoxemia, or like, what are the other things that could explain this if you put all the puzzle pieces together of blood flow problems, hemodynamics, and so.
So I want to kind of give you my perspective first about the lipoprotein system, and then we'll talk about some of the very interesting questions you raised as to why is plaque buildup, you know, I refuse to call it atherosclerosis, because atherosclerosis implies a causation of the lipoprotein being implicated in actually as a causative agent. So I'm firmly on your side that whether the LDL as a lipoprotein is actually the causal factor in the plaque buildup is not clearly known by any stretch of imagination, at least from my review of literature and being a clinician for 30 years, because I have seen people with LDL cholesterols of 30 or sometimes even lower who come in with heart attacks, who have extensive plaque buildup with calcification in all three blood vessels that supply the heart muscle. So I'll address that in a little bit as to the questions that you raised as to why you often see patients with accidental death who have extensive plaque buildup, many blocked blood vessels of the heart, and yet when you examine the heart muscle, you don't find any evidence of scar tissue in the heart muscle. So the blood vessels of the heart are supplying the heart muscle with nutrients, with blood flow, and you would expect that if the blood vessel is occluded, that the heart muscle that is supplied by that blood vessel should die. So let's shelf that for a second and talk about the lipoprotein system. And when I talk about the lipoprotein system, it's basically LDL, HDL, VLDL, chylomicrons, all these molecules which have a phospholipid bilayer with some key identifying proteins which are different from a chylomicron to an LDL to an HDL. And when you look at the lipoprotein system, you got to recognize a few aspects about it. Number one is that evolutionarily it's very conserved. It's there even in an insect and it's there in humans. The second aspect that you got to recognize is that the reason it is there is because it has to fulfill several biologic functions. One of the functions is immune defense, host defense. Lipoproteins are implicated in preventing infections, in reducing inflammation, in cell repair. Now, lipoproteins are also a key integral factor in reverse transport of material, reverse transport of cholesterol from cells that are constantly renewing themselves. There is apoptosis, there is cell death. So that debris and extra lipid material in a cell has to be recycled. So that's called reverse cholesterol transport, or RCT. And RCT is not just performed by the LDL, but it's also performed by the HDL alone, which is the high density lipoprotein, but the HDL and the LDL communicate with each other quite intricately because they are sharing triglycerides and cholesterol esters through different proteins. The other function of the lipoprotein is energy delivery. To some degree, they cycle the triglycerides between the liver and the intestine to fat cells, to muscle cells. So energy delivery is an important component that cannot be ignored in the lipoprotein situation. Finally, they are carrying a lot of different molecules that are important for cellular function. One of them could be CoQ10. Another would be antioxidants. And there are certain specialized lipoproteins such as Lp(a) that may have a very pronounced antioxidant function and a function in helping repair vessels after you have had a traumatic injury so that you don't bleed to death. So to implicate an evolutionarily conserved system as being dysfunctional and causing plaque buildup, which many people call atherosclerosis, is overtly simplistic. I think it is wrong. It ignores a lot of functions that these molecules do, and just blocking one enzyme and expecting everything to get right is wrong, or to just go and block a PCSK9 protein, which is controlling the amount of LDL in circulation and expecting everything to be hunky-dory, I think is a completely wrong aspect of traditional medicine, mainstream medicine. And it's probably primarily geared through the pharmaceutical industry to promote it. So I'll pause for a second so that you guys can give your comments about what I said about the lipoprotein system, and if you want to expand on any of that before we can move on to the other question that you brought up.
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely something that resonates with me, because there's, I mean, when you look at the movement of lipoproteins around the artery, there's one of the facts that I stumbled upon was that if you look at this, the concentration of lipoproteins in the fluid of the arterial wall, just even a healthy artery, it's actually double what it is in serum, which implies that there's an active mechanism that's moving the lipoprotein from the serum through transcytosis into the arterial wall, which, you know, there are certain characteristics of active mechanisms, like you'd expect homeostatic control, feedback loops, or things like that, which the whole thing seems a little bit fishy, especially like the general principle that evolution would fail, like as you talk about the conservation of this mechanism, the idea that an endogenously synthesized protein and cholesterol molecule, like that to me seems kind of far-fetched that would be what's going on here. And I mean, I understand if you look historically, it's clear that the technology to measure the cholesterol concentration and to stain the cholesterol was the first that was developed. And so when they were looking what's inside of these lesions, that's, I guess, the first thing that they saw, and they jumped to the conclusion that that must be a causal agent somehow, rather than, you know, just part of the structure of the human tissue. That, you know, it's sort of like the way I described it is if you had pus in a cut and you kind of concluded that must have caused the infected wound. You know, it's looking at the end state of a complex process. And, you know, I don't know if you have anything to add, Nathan, but I definitely. One of the other things we stumbled upon actually was that it turns out that statins have pleiotropic effects. I don't know if you're familiar with this, but they interact with the immune response through the TLR4 receptor, which basically one of the studies showed that if you had a certain mutation in TLR4, statins became substantially more effective at reducing your risk of heart attack, totally independent of the lipoprotein concentrations. Because one of the things that we've observed is that you have several different medications. One of them was evacetrapib, which lowered LDL and raised HDL and had absolutely no effect on mortality whatsoever. And then you have another pill called statin that lowers LDL and has, you know, some, I won't say it's a huge effect, but it has a moderate effect. And then when you see that there's not a dose response here, you know, you take a PCSK9 inhibitor and it drops your LDL to 30 and the mortality doesn't budge, versus you take a statin and it lowers the LDL by, you know, 50% and the mortality kind of still doesn't budge. You know, that alone, the fact that you have kind of not a clear relationship between the amount of lowering that a pill does and the outcome metric kind of tells you, it clues you in that there's more to the and what's going on. You know?
So I guess you're singing to the choir here as far as you're talking to me about lipoprotein profile, because I've made some of the very same points that you have talked about. Jupiter trial dropping LDL by 50% using rosuvastatin, the difference in mortality, all-cause mortality, was less than 0.5%, which is a ridiculous number when you look at 19,000 patients. The four-year trial using PCSK9 inhibitors, dropping LDL cholesterol to 30 compared to 19, the control group, and mind you, these are 28,000 patients. And actually, not only no difference in mortality, but a higher mortality in the treatment group than in the control group. So I couldn't agree with you more that working on a single aspect of the lipoprotein profile and expecting to have a difference is wrong. And I'd like to challenge people about the pleiotropic effects of statins, because I think that the pleiotropic effects of statins are in some ways invented by researchers who have a sort of a personal gain in terms of saying that they do good things. Because if you look at the mechanisms by which statins work, they are mitochondrial toxins. They reduce glutathione oxidase, which is a very important antioxidant defense in our body. They do affect the cholesterol rafts that are there at the level of the insulin receptor. They may make the toll-like receptors, the TLR4, become less active, because there are cholesterol rafts in macrophages also that would affect the expression of these receptors, and dropping endogenous cholesterol production might cause a slight degree of benefit. But compared to the damage to the mitochondria through CoQ10, through the pathway in which they reduce the antioxidants that the body naturally produces, through directly reducing vitamin K2 production, through directly affecting the insulin receptor, I think that their pleiotropic effects are in the negative direction, not in the positive direction. And
yeah, I could totally see that. It would make sense for pleiotropy to go both ways. It's, of course, not always going to be beneficial. And in statin's case, it seems to swing in the direction of not beneficial. But I think the point you made about the medical system thinking that simply lowering LDL, I think there's a lot of hubris in that. And I'm not sure how well that's recognized. And then going back to the immune part, I actually just did a Twitter thread today about I looked at statins, CETP inhibitors, PCSK9 inhibitors, niacin, and bile acid sequestrants. And there's mechanistic plausibility for the immune modulatory effects of all of those. Interestingly, it also explains why CETP inhibitors didn't work, because they actually impair immune function instead of improving it.
I couldn't agree more. The fundamental aspect of why the lipoprotein system is there is to exchange triglycerides and cholesterol esters between HDL and LDL, and you use a CETP inhibitor and you prevent that, you're going to have an increased risk of cancers, a higher mortality, perhaps a higher infection rate. Because what we are failing to recognize is immunology, host defense, immune surveillance is so closely linked with the lipoprotein system. So when you think about lipoprotein system, you should not think of it as something that helps causes plaque. You got to think of it in a much more broader perspective, that this is there to do so many different functions. And what we need to do is to understand how can we make the lipoprotein system the most optimal in terms of human health. And I really think that the most optimal way in which you can improve the lipoprotein system is to have a low level of triglycerides, in other words, have very low VLDL, because that's basically fat energy that's hanging in the bloodstream, have a fairly decent level of HDL. And as far as the LDL cholesterol is concerned, it is probably should be individualized, because people who are physically active, who are healthy, who are doing a large amount of physical activity, are doing fasting, I would expect, and I uniformly see, just like you guys have seen, that the LDL levels are very, very high. And I'm not sure, I'm not prepared to say that that is a bad thing at all. And the reason is that I see 90-year-olds, 90, 95-year-olds with LDL cholesterol in the 250s. And I take them to the cardiac cath lab and I find that their blood vessels are pristine. That is smooth lumen, normal looking blood vessels with normal flow. And here is a molecule that is so implicated in plaque buildup. What happened out here? Why didn't it affect these people in 90 years?
Constantine Velikin had a quote or something. It said, like, such logical deductions are extremely rare in the field of, like, atherosclerosis research, because that's the kind, that's what you should conclude if you see that, right? That's what, you know, if you see right. an anomalous observation like that.
And it's not an isolated anomalous observation. Like, if I saw one patient, I would say, hey, you know, this is crazy. But if you see 80-year-olds and you see that their LDL level is high, their cholesterol level is high, I turn around and congratulate them and saying that, hey, you've got a very robust lipoprotein system. I think that you are at lower risks of infection, lower risks of cancers, that your mortality is lower compared to your peers with lower cholesterol. They look at me and they are quite perplexed, because that is the concern that the entire mainstream medicine has raised for them for the last 30 to 50 years. And they are just not able to digest that. And I have trouble dealing with my colleagues because my stance is, like, I would say, if of all the 500 cardiologists in the Houston area, I could probably point to one guy, one other person who would say, hey, having a high LDL in the setting of a very good lipoprotein profile, just like we talked about, a low insulin level, a low triglycerides, high HDL, which is somebody who's very insulin sensitive, is good. Nobody else, none of the other cardiologists are willing to take that stance.
And so,
go ahead.
So, I mean, a lot of people point to the correlation, just the weak correlation of LDL in general with the disease incidence. And what bothers me is that if you dig into that correlation, you know, one is that if A causes B, you expect A and B to correlate very strongly. If A and B don't always correlate, or A and B correlate weakly and sometimes not at all, that is kind of your answer right there. If you're asking if A causes B, the answer is clearly no. And further, LDL doesn't even independently associate with cardiac mortality or CVD mortality, because I think Dave Feldman's challenge, where he's been dangling $3,000 for just the data that if you hold HDL and triglycerides in optimal positions and vary LDL, that you'd see any change. You know, he's been asking for that data for what, a year or more now, and has the absolute radio silence receiving even a single observation that suggests that higher LDL incurs greater risk in people who have otherwise healthy bodies. Because that's one of the things you see in low carb, is that, you know, my hypertension is gone, my body weight is normalized, my visceral adipose tissue is down by 95%, and my HDL has gone up and my triglycerides have gone down, but this one thing's going wrong. And the argument is essentially that LDL is more important than everything else about your health, which I think is almost, I don't know, I don't agree with that, to say the least.
I think as far as that is concerned, we are in an echo chamber. We all reflect each other's views. I want to take a minute to go back to your previous point, because it's quite interesting, and I don't know if we will have any real answers to that. But let's take the situation of an acute myocardial infarction. So unstable angina is different than an acute MI. In unstable angina, you have a vessel that is threatening to close but has not completely closed. So you get EKG changes that are different than in an acute heart attack, which is called an acute myocardial infarction. Another name for that is acute MI. Some people refer to it as ST elevation MI. So in this situation, the blood vessel, usually this blood vessel has a blockage and it gets completely closed by a blood clot. And it happens all of a sudden, and in this situation, the person starts having chest pain, EKG changes, and these patients seek medical attention. And when they come to the hospital, there's a protocol for activating the cardiac cath team. So the cardiac cath team is activated. The cardiologists like me and other people who work in the cath lab rush to the hospital. They take the patient to the cardiac cath lab, and then they do a coronary angiogram. You thread a plastic tube through the femoral artery all the way to the heart and look at the pictures of the blood vessels of the heart. You find the blood vessel that is causing the heart attack. You put a wire across that blockage. You open that up with a balloon and stent. And like I was telling you at the beginning of the podcast, that is when the patient starts feeling better. That's when the chest pain goes away. That's when the ST segment elevation goes down. So the blood clot is clearly a causal factor in an acute heart attack, no matter which way you want to dice it. And I was looking at some of the information on the book that you forwarded, and I think it tries to give you an idea that may not be completely accurate, but that is more or less the picture 90 to 95% of the time. Now, there were people back in the 1960s and 70s who said that the heart muscle dies first. And since the heart muscle dies, that's when the blood vessel, because the flow is not needed, the blood clot came as a result of the heart muscle dying. And that was the NIH professor, William C. Roberts. But that was inaccurate, because there was a Western Washington trial a study that was done in which for the first time, because at that time in 1970s, if you took a patient having a heart attack to the cardiac cath lab, it was considered malpractice. But they took them to the cardiac cath lab, took pictures of the blood vessels of the heart, showed that the blood vessels were blocked with a clot, dripped some clot-busting drug, opened up the blood vessel, and then relieved the heart attack. So I think as far as that is concerned, I would like to go on record and say that the blood clot is the primary reason, and a blockage of the blood vessel where the blood clot occurs is most common factor causing a heart attack. Now, that is not the same situation. Like, let's say I see a 50-year-old gentleman who's complaining of some chest pain. He's obviously not having a heart attack. I take him through the cardiac cath lab, and I can find a number of different scenarios which will corroborate the work that you sent to me. A scenario would be that he has a 90% blockage of the blood vessel of the heart. He has no collateral blood flow around that blockage. There's no collateral flow from other blood vessels that are coming and supplying the heart muscle downstream. And in that situation, if there is documented reduction of blood flow through the blockage, opening it up with a stent will definitely improve this person's quality of life, exercise tolerance, and chest pain. So that is there. Now, on the other hand, go ahead.
Yeah, so, I mean, that's what's interesting to us, was because Baroldi had suggested, I mean, Velikin had stated that it sounded like this particular pathology was not, like the heart attacks that are not explained by like a thrombe and a inside of a stenosis were probably on the rarer side. They were not necessarily more common. The other thing was...
But I think he was wrong there.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, if you look at, and there are a substantial number of heart attacks throughout the country on a yearly basis. And when you have a true diagnosis of a heart attack with ST segment elevation myocardial infarction, you would see that 95% of this is because of a blood clot in a location where the blood vessel is blocked.
Yeah, but what Baroldi seemed to imply was that in many cases, collaterals form around stenoses. And you suggested that in that particular case, there appears to be some differentiation. Like, some people may get collaterals that grow around the stenosis to pick up the slack, and others may not, which I think is an interesting idea. And
So there's no question that I see collaterals all the time. I think that the pathologist that you mentioned, and I'm sorry, I'm blocking out on their name, Baroldi, I guess. The pathologists have seen these events postmortem with different kinds of fixation of the heart. But I see collaterals on a daily basis in the cardiac cath lab. And collaterals are very variable. In other words, some people have very robust collaterals. Like, for example, if I were to take you to a different situation, a 50-year-old coming to me for chest pain, and I suspect this is from his coronary artery disease, I take him to the cardiac cath lab, and let's say the blood vessel supplying the front of the heart, which is the LAD, is 100% blocked. And yet, he's got excellent collateral vessels that are bypassing that blockage coming from the right coronary artery. And when I take a picture of the pumping chamber of the heart, which is telling me if the heart muscle is dead or no, I see that the heart muscle is completely normal. In other words, there has been no evidence of damage to the heart muscle. Now, that's not as sensitive as doing an MRI. Now, you could do an MRI, and the MRI would show whether there was small spotty areas of damage to the heart muscle through different techniques. So, you know, you can find out more details about the heart muscle in such a situation. So in that situation, yes, you do see that, and collaterals have protected this person. But to make a blanket statement that, yeah, you would get blockages, but really almost everybody would get collaterals that would protect their heart muscle downstream, that is where I would probably not be willing to participate and say, yeah, I support that notion.
We're not expecting you to agree with everything that we that we present. I just thought it was interesting because there were some observations that at least in some people, but I think that begs the question of like, well, what differentiates someone's ability to create collateral vessels, and what are the cases in which collateral vessels don't seem to pick up the slack, I think is another interesting question that follows from that, which we're definitely curious about.
You know, you don't necessarily have to be a rocket scientist to find that out, right? Like, for example, if somebody is getting a blockage that is gradually developing over several years, and they already have some collaterals, almost all blood vessels in the heart have some degree of collaterals. And I think that the definitive study to tell that how many of us have collaterals from birth that can mature easily over time and how quickly they can mature over time as the blockage or the blood flow through the main blood vessel gets restricted is not clearly known. We don't know that answer. I mean, even though this pathologist has done an excellent job in terms of gathering information, this information is something that probably will take a lot more work. So if the blood vessel is slowly becoming blocked and that person, in my opinion, is, let's say, physically active and exercising and trying to augment blood flow to the heart muscle, which is needed to exercise, then there are more reasons for the collateral blood flow to get established and get better over time. On the other hand, if the blockage is at about 50%, it's not really stopping blood flow downstream, then what would happen is that, let's say that there was an event, you know, a sudden surge of adrenaline, a stressful event, a sudden increase in blood pressure. Let's say that this person became severely insulin resistant, or there was some other inflammation going on, and you had plaque rupture. You know, you had the blood vessel rupture, it forms a blood clot, it closes the blood vessel. In that situation, the collaterals would not have time to have formed robustly to protect this person from having a heart attack. So there are plausible theories about collateralization, what promotes the collaterals, and those are very interesting aspects to explore. And the fault of interventional cardiologists like me is to treat every blockage as something that we need to fix. And it is people like you and the larger community discussion that should come about and say, hey, yeah, this blockage is there, but for some good reason, this person has neutralized the downside of that blockage by forming these collaterals around this blockage. The blood supply downstream is adequate enough that subjecting this patient to a stent and opening up this blood vessel is not necessary. And that's one of the reasons why you find variability in studies that compare stents versus medical therapy. You know, take a 67-year-old, like you said, and do nothing. And you find that there is only a 7% mortality according to you in 5 years or 10 years. And you're saying, hey, this is a low mortality. What's going on? If this blockage was so bad, why didn't all of these guys die? Right? Isn't that your question?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's definitely very interesting to anyone, especially a lot of people who are trying to manage advanced atherosclerosis using a carbohydrate restriction or other dietary and lifestyle interventions to understand this, you know, because I think that, as you say, it's very easy to just put stents everywhere, but, you know, there seems to be a lot more to the problem that could inform someone who's, especially like, I have family members that are necessarily not at a clear place, like medical therapy, non-medical therapy, lifestyle intervention, what do you do? And you know, how important is lifestyle and how much will we be able to work around, you know, X percent occlusion in an artery? And I think it's very interesting from a more holistic perspective to consider all these different possibilities, if that makes sense.
No, absolutely.
And I think the hypothesis about, you know, like a 50% occlusion in someone who's sedentary and then suddenly having some kind of surge in demand, that makes a heck of a lot of sense. I think that seems like a very plausible explanation that matches with, you know, traditional science and your clinical experience and all of that.
The other thing we've looked into a lot is the role of immune activation, because a lot of the times through all, it seems to be one of the things that is lesser explored is both the immune interactions of lipoproteins, but also the larger role of the immune system within atherogenesis and potentially stress levels and myocardial infarction and nervous system and all these different parameters. And I don't know if you have any thoughts on that or if you've looked into it. You mentioned it with the lipoprotein system, but I don't know what you have any thoughts.
Well, I mean, as far as the immune system is concerned and as far as host defense is concerned, I think it's so intricately tied to the lipoproteins. Like, for example, the LPS binding protein, the lipopolysaccharide binding protein, that is a protein that is carried in the LDL molecule. It facilitates the transfer of LPS into the LDL so that you can dampen down inflammation. The same situation happens in terms of inflammation, because with inflammation, there is always cellular debris, there is cell death, and a lot of the lipopolysaccharide, which is basically small components of cell membranes hooked to some sugar residues, they are floating around. Those things need to be cleared. And I think that our lipoprotein system was designed to do this, because think what happens is that when you have an infection or when you have an inflammation, the liver has a number of proteins that it elaborates, and one of them is the acute phase reactants, these are called. These are proteins that the liver puts out to help the body. One of them is the LPS binding protein. A second protein that it puts out, which is an acute phase reactant, is not surprisingly PCSK9. So PCSK9 is a protein that the liver is pumping out in the situation of inflammation and infection. The reason that it is doing that is because it wants the LDL, it wants the VLDL to remain in circulation so that it can mop up the inflammation that's going on, mop up the bacteria that are there and their products. And that's why the PCSK9 goes and binds to the LDL receptor, internalizes it, and degrades it in the lysosomes so that LDL is not removed circulation. So I think that the basic training of every cardiologist should be that, hey, let's spend 6 months with the lipoprotein system. Let's see what is it doing. Let's bring the field of immunology, infectious disease, and cardiology together to figure this out. Now, unfortunately, that's not happened so far, but I'm very optimistic. It's people like Dave Feldman, people like Ivor Cummins, people such as yourself, Nick and Nathan, you are beginning this conversation. And this conversation is not just limited to the physicians. It's a larger conversation that the entire society is participating in. And it's only when we do these kinds of talks, when we bring this knowledge to the masses, is when we are going to change this. We're not going to change this by academic discussion in the halls of universities and NIH or with the pharmaceutical companies, because they are biased. Right now, you mentioned about immune complexes as being something that is of concern. But see, what are you doing when you're giving a PCSK9 inhibitor? You're giving an antibody to a person that's going to go bind the PCSK9. So that is an antigen antibody complex in a way that needs to be cleared. So it makes no sense to me that you are injecting an antibody into somebody, a parenteral antibody into somebody, and expecting something good to come out of it when the PCSK9 is so homeostatically regulated in our human body. And so I find it that the mainstream medicine and the pharmaceutical company are only profit motivated. They are not motivated to explore these finer questions. Or if they are, they're not putting it out as questions that everybody should be involved in.
My suspicion is that they know a lot more than they're letting on to, you know, especially with the competence of these people to synthesize these compounds, you know. But it's funny, Nathan was just sending me sepsis research papers earlier today talking about the dose-dependent clearance of LPS with LDL and everything. It's really fascinating, but it's a little bit shocking that you have to leave the field of atherosclerosis and go into sepsis research before you start seeing people talk about these immune interactions of lipoproteins and the possibility that they're doing something beneficial, you know.
Right.
Yeah, and I guess we should just give you our hypothesis at the moment.
Good.
So you can give us our thoughts on it. Basically, our thought is that it's all driven by the gut-immune interaction. So our current food environment is terrible, which leads to gut dysbiosis and intestinal permeability with things like food additives, emulsifiers, carbohydrates leading to dysbiosis, and God knows what else, fructose, alcohol, pretty much anything else. That dysbiosis leads to increased permeability and increased transport of LPS and LTA and other cellular debris into the body. And that leads to basically systemic inflammation. And those circulating LPS, essentially in the areas of slow and low flow in the coronary artery, trigger localized immune activation, hyperactivation, I guess you could say, which leads to the development of plaques.
And one of the things that's kind of interesting is discovering more and more about how all these systems of immune activation and inflammation are very nuanced. It's not as simple as more inflammation is bad. You need some inflammation. Inflammation is part of these various biologic cycles, so it doesn't necessarily require that the immune activation is particularly heightened. It's sufficient for it to just be disrupted by potentially, you know, a stimulus like a constant drip of garbage food that causes your serum endotoxin levels to be in abnormal places. Because I think Gabor was, we were talking with him earlier this week, and he mentioned that it's actually part of the body's natural response when it needs to trigger inflammation is to open up the gut barrier to let in LPS. It's part of its normal functionality, but you can imagine if such a mechanism were abused that these, there's probably a lot more nuance to this than just a simple A causes B, you know, when it comes to all these complex biological systems. But I think it's interesting to explore.
I mean, I think that gut permeability that you talk about and the increase in inflammation as a result of that is definitely something on my radar, and I always think about it. And so if I were to pose a question back to you, in that situation, when you have a lot of LPS floating around, you need that mopped up. You need that taken care of. So in that
exactly,
situation,
I'll take my LDLP of 3,500 in that case. I think I'll be spared from infection and inflammation.
You took the words out of my mouth.
Exactly, because the paper that I found that I sent Nick, I said it was a gold mine because they were showing that the clearance of LPS was actually in a dose-dependent relationship with the concentration of LDL.
Can you send me that paper too?
Yeah, I'll tag you on the Twitter thread with all the stuff that I went through today, which was looking at HDL and how HDL and LDL help clear up LPS and why CETP inhibitors mess with that, because CETP helps LPS, or helps HDL and LDL transfer LPS around along with phospholipid transfer protein. And a bunch of other pretty neat stuff that I dug up today while I was on the plane to San Diego.
Yeah. No, I mean, no question. I think that I have a couple of friends who are infectious disease people, and they never looked at the lipoprotein system the way I want them to look at it. And now that I have given several talks in which I talk about quorum sensing with regards to the LDL and the LPS binding protein and the LPS, they have started looking at the lipoprotein system in a very different way. So I like that conversation. Now, as far as gut permeability is concerned, another thing that we need to stress to people, I think, is that to reduce gut permeability, our stomach acid, because we have a monogastric stomach, our digestion is based on acid pepsin digestion, and preservation of your stomach acid is vitally important for our health. And there are studies that show that as we get older, the stomach acid levels go down. So one of the ways to control dysbiosis is to reduce the bacterial overgrowth in the small intestines, which is the main absorptive surface. And the stomach acid is an ecological barrier to prevent increase in bacterial overgrowth in the small intestines. So the more you protect your stomach acid, the better it is. And unfortunately, mainstream medicine actually makes stomach acid worse because...
Oh yeah, we give everybody the PPIs.
PPIs and antacids and H2 blockers. And then also, we are in the habit of eating a large amount of salad at the beginning of our meal. And the salad is basically food that is laden with bacteria, and it has all kinds of chemicals that will block protein absorption, that'll dilute out the stomach acid, that'll bind to many minerals. And so you are promoting dysbiosis by making people eat raw vegetable material at the beginning of their meal. And actually, they should be eating a protein part of their meal at the beginning of their meal to use their stomach acid the best.
That makes a lot of sense.
This
don't
is
have
all
to tell me twice.
Incredibly fascinating because of the, I don't know, there are a lot of things that I've read in the past and I was like, oh, there's no way that's important. But, you know, the more you get into it, the more it seems like there's a lot going on in the digestive system that and one of my interesting ideas is, you know, how very nuanced aspects of the food influence our health. You know, it seems like there's probably a lot, like even when you move past a caloric balance theory of weight management and you get through the carbohydrate insulin model, it looks like there's probably multiple layers beyond that that influence the way that health and food in particular interacts with our health in ways that we have yet to understand, which I think is pretty interesting.
I agree. Hey, so can I ask the two of you to promote Low Carb Houston? We are doing a university-based low-carb program in Houston. It's run by University of Houston, Clear Lake. It's all the proceeds go, you register through the university, so all the money goes to the university. None of the faculty or the program directors are directly benefiting from it in any way. So it's to promote this idea of nutrition, lipoproteins, fasting, intermittent fasting, lifestyle to one of the most metabolically challenged city in the country. And so I don't know, it's lowcarbhouston.com.
Yeah, that's awesome. We'll share that and I'll let you continue with your message, but I'll retweet you and we'll put that in the show notes.
And I invite both of you to come if you can. We were at Low Carb Seattle. This is primarily a science-based program. We are not running it as an exhibition. We are not trying to run it as a commercial endeavor. It is meant for the general public. I have Ivor coming there. I have Dave Feldman coming there. Jeff Gerber will be coming, Megan Ramos, David Diamond, Peter Ballerstad, Amber O'Hearn, Amy Berger. So any number of great people, and I'm sure that all of us admire and respect every single individual that I just talked about.
That sounds, yeah. I would love to join. I'll see if I can make time for that. That sounds good.
It's October 24th to 26th. It's a Thursday, Friday, and Saturday. We're going to have a Texas style barbecue.
Okay, I'm coming.
Sign me up. I'll be there. I think I should be around then. I'll fly out to Houston. Never been before.
That's the best barbecue anywhere in the world. And there is the guy out here who's been making it for like 100 years.
Runs
the restaurant. And I did it last year. We had great response to the program. This year, I'm hoping for it to be even bigger and carry the message and carry the discussion forward, just extending the work that you are doing.
Yeah, we might have to talk to you about maybe getting a talk in or something.
I'd love for you to guys think about giving a talk. I could put you on the stage for giving a talk. You send me your ideas and tell me.
We'll be there in 10 seconds if you give us that opportunity. We'd be happy to put something together.
Awesome. So do you mind shooting me an email and discussing some topics about what you would like to talk about? Because seriously, I'd like to include you guys. I have so many talks that I can take myself off and put you on the schedule.
I'll take that invitation. Yeah, we'll shoot that off to you. So my plane flight departs in a few minutes, so I've got to get meandering over to my gate. But this has been pretty awesome talking to you. Thank you so much for joining us and giving your thoughts and everything.
Yeah, thanks for joining us. Thanks for your time.
Nathan, I hope it met your expectations because I tried reading that book, but I was falling off to sleep with every second paragraph last night.
Oh, it was so dense. It is. We appreciate the time you put into it. Your insight and commentary was very, very informative.
All right, my friend. I'll see you both in Houston.
Absolutely. Be there.
Take care.
Sounds good. See ya.
Bye-bye.